This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 12, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 116. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest, the big deal feature. I welcome back Dermot Travis of Integrity BC, who ponders the state of BC politics and discusses some of Victoria's secrets. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or did the first week or so of 2020 feel like a month already? Consider the stories. Donald Trump ordered the drone bombing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, who was visiting Baghdad. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh went to Twitter to tell Trump to stop messing around in Iran. The Twitter sphere reminded Singh that Baghdad is in Iraq. Iran retaliated with dozens of missiles shot at two American military bases in Iraq, but none of them did any real big damage. Meanwhile, Iran shot down a Ukrainian commercial jet carrying dozens and dozens of Canadians. Nobody survived. Taiwanese re-elected their independence-minded president, yet another blow to Xi Jinping and mainland China's ambitions. Hereditary Wet'suwet'en chiefs defied a court order and evicted Coastal GasLink workers from a $6 billion pipeline construction project in central British Columbia. A United Nations committee called for the government to support the natives. Winter weather returned to the lower mainland of British Columbia, a real climate crisis for those trying to get around the gridlock, to get over the Portman and Alex Fraser bridges and dodge ice bombs. It's even worse for the homeless. Conservative leadership hopeful Jean Charest, the former Quebec Liberal premier, is giving China's Huawei legal advice. Ricky Gervais hosted the Golden Globe Awards and deflated the egos of Hollywood stars and power brokers on live TV. They didn't love it, but viewers did. Pop singer Justin Bieber admitted that he has Lyme disease. Royal couple Meghan and Harry quit the royal family the day after a highly publicized visit to the Canadian High Commission in London, where they snacked on Nanaimo bars. Meghan returned to British Columbia, where they had stayed over the Christmas holidays. So if that's what the first 10 days or so of 2020 brought us, this is really going to be a roaring decade. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Jason Pan reports in the Taipei Times, Tsai thanks voters. President Tsai Ing-wen led her Democratic Progressive Party to victory in the January 11th elections with 8.1 million votes, or 57% of the total ballots cast. She handily defeated Kaohsiung Mayor Han Kuo-yu of the Chinese Nationalist Party. She thanked Taiwanese for choosing progress and democracy, and to continue their way of life of freedom. Mental health issues rise drastically, with more than 2 million adults showing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, study finds. More than 2 million, or almost 1 in 3, Hong Kong adults have shown symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder during the prolonged civil unrest in the city, a study published in a leading medical journal has found. The number was 6 times higher than 4 years ago, just after the Occupy protests had ended. University of Hong Kong academics who conducted the study urged the government to step up its mental health provisions. Their research also suggested that up to 11% of the city's adult population was affected by probable depression last year, 5 times higher than the figure collected from 2009 to 2014, when it was just 2%. The research was published in an article in The Lancet. James Findlay writes for ABC News Australia, what to say to someone who has lost their home in the Australian bushfires. On New Year's Eve, our family home, my parents' dream home, the home my dad built 27 years ago, went up in flames. But we're not alone. Thousands of Australian families have lost their homes this summer. People have lost their homes, their farms, their businesses. Far worse, some people have lost loved ones. As someone whose family home is now ash, iron, and rubble, here's some advice on what to say and what perhaps not to say. Avoid talking about hypothetical situations. Don't say, "I hope you have insurance." It might not be the time for optimism. Do ask, "Is there anything I can do?" Also, "I'm sorry" does help. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the North Shore News, Brent Richter and Jane Sade report, North Van mourns seven neighbors lost in Tehran crash. The North Shore's Iranian community is reeling following the deaths of seven local Persians in the crash of UK... 3-2-1. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the North Shore News, Brent Richter and Jane Seed report, North Van mourns seven neighbors lost in Tehran crash. The North Shore's Iranian community is reeling following the deaths of seven local Persians in the crash of Ukraine International Airlines Flight 752 in Tehran. On Wednesday night, hundreds of people came to a vigil outside Amir Bakery in central Lonsdale, the family business of Amir Pasavand and his wife, Avyeshe Porgaderi. Porgaderi and the couple's daughter, Fatima Pasavand, a student at Carson Graham, both died in the crash. Langara College student Dilaram Dedeshenajad died as well. Dedeshenajad was an international student flying home to Vancouver after a visit with family in Tehran, according to a statement released Tuesday morning by Langara President Lane Trotter. The North Shore is home to one of the largest communities of Persians in Canada, according to the last census. With almost 13,000 of BC's total 19,000 immigrants from Iran making their homes here. In the last census period alone, almost 3,000 newcomers came from Iran. In the Bend Bulletin, Oregon State bans all tobacco products from its campuses. Oregon State University banned chewing and hookah tobacco products at its Corvallis and Bend campuses. Both campuses already banned smoking and vaping in 2012. The University of Oregon and Portland State University banned all tobacco products in 2014. Joseph O'Sullivan reports in the Seattle Times, "Please leave the chair. Inslee makes Iman a punchline after anti-tax activist interrupts question and answer session." Tim Iman, a declared candidate for governor, interrupted Governor Jay Inslee's session with reporters on January 9th. Iman, who last year reached a settlement on charges he stole a $70 rolling chair from an Office Depot in Lacey, Washington, confronted Inslee about the car tab reduction measure passed in November, which is now in the hands of the courts. Quote, "You're welcome to have a chair," end quote, Inslee said before Iman left. Inslee also said, "Please leave the chair when you leave." And looking ahead to more headlines in 2020, mark these dates on your calendar. The dates are set for the Cullen Commission inquiry hearings, the British Columbia public inquiry into money laundering. From February 24th to 28th, participants will make their opening statements. From May 25th to June 26th, overview hearings about money laundering and the extent of money laundering in British Columbia. The main event, the main hearings from September 8th to December 22nd to get to the bottom of specific issues such as gambling, casinos and horse racing, real estate, accounting and legal, banks, Bitcoin, cash-based businesses, and the government response to money laundering. Stay tuned. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. This week's guest is Dermot Travis, Executive Director of Integrity BC, who joins me on the phone from Victoria. We're now in 2020, inching closer to the scheduled October 2021 provincial election. I asked Dermot whether he thinks Premier John Horgan might call an early election sometime this year. He is one of the few individuals who thinks Premier Horgan will run out the clock and go the full term.
35% chance he might try for an election this year. But one thing that has puzzled me, and quite frankly I think is incredibly misleading when it's put forward by some reporters, is this idea that the Green Party can bring down the government. Three members of the legislature are not capable of bringing down the government without the support of the BC Liberal Party. And the full support of the BC Liberal yes, we will vote with you, but we're going to have four or five of our members out there with the flu. And in order for that to happen, where you have the Greens and the Liberals lined up, ready to go into an election, the stars will have to be aligned perfectly for those two parties. Cash in the bank, good polling numbers, bad polling numbers for the NDP. And I don't see that scenario developing. And I think when a reporter with a daily newspaper starts talking about how the Greens can bring down the government, that reporter has a duty to actually explain the necessity for the Liberals to support that motion in order for that to happen. They do not, three members, have the capacity to bring the government down.
Now that Andrew Weaver has passed the reins of leadership to Adam Olson, the interim leader, the party has announced a process for choosing a new full-time leader for June. But now you have Adam Olson as the leader of the party. He's Indigenous, and this is at a time when John Horgan is really promoting the NDP government's moves to recognize the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It would not be good form. It would not look good on John Horgan to call an election at this time when Adam Olson is holding on to the temporary leadership of the Green Party as the party tries to find its new footing with a new leader.
And there's always generally been a sort of old boys club rule that you don't go into an election when you know that one of the parties is in the midst of a leadership race. Obviously, there is another alternative if John Horgan wants to go to the polls, and that would be to go to the lieutenant governor and ask for an election to be called. But in that particular scenario, he's going to have a really good reason to do that, that it's not going to be perceived simply as an opportunistic move on the part of the NDP, either because they're doing well in the polls or there's a belief that the economy is going to tank, and therefore this is his best opportunity. So his agreement with the Greens, quite frankly, I think is going to survive. I think he's obviously going to be in a delicate situation if one of the if the new leader of the party is not one of the sitting MLAs, because that could bring in a new dynamic, could give him the room to be able to call an election, and for the public to see it as a legitimate reason to go to the polls.
The second anniversary of Andrew Wilkinson's leadership of the BC Liberal Party is at the start of February. He edged Diane Watts at the leadership convention. I asked Dermot what he has learned about Wilkinson's leadership contest and his public expenses.
One of the things I've learned, and I learned it from Andrew Wilkinson, and doesn't deal with his expenses directly, but does touch upon the second anniversary issue, is that he stated to a reporter that there's roughly only 200,000 British Columbians who know who he is. Well, if that's where you're at today, potentially a year away from a fixed election date, you've got a lot of work to do. And one of the issues that I found going through the expense travel claims for various MLAs over the last year and a half demonstrates that he's certainly racking up the flyer points in order to try to get himself the necessary exposure. Regrettably, and I think this is what the public should be most concerned about with these travel expenses, is not necessarily what the objective of the expense was, but more the location of where the expense was. So I noted that in September, this past September, they had a caucus meeting in Courtney Comox. Well, that's a swing riding. Earlier in the end of spring, they had a caucus meeting in Maple Ridge, also two swing ridings. What I have found is that there seems to be, more often than not, a direct correlation between an MLA's travel expenses coming out of their nonpartisan constituency office budget and the electoral needs of the BC Liberal Party. And this is one of the things that I think the Legislative Assembly Management Committee has to address when it comes back, is do we want to have an MLA's travel constituency budget being used in, quite frankly, a blatantly partisan manner by a party that had only a year ago been accusing the government, the NDP, of using constituency offices for partisan purposes. Well, you can't have it both ways. And it's regrettable in British Columbia, and you always hear this, well, that's just the way it's done here. Well, I'm sorry, that is not an excuse. It's not a good reason. But in British Columbia, there seems to be a tendency to allow public funds to be directly used, as you've reported on, for partisan political purposes. In other provinces, you are not allowed to use government funds for your caucus, for your constituency offices, for partisan purposes. And we saw Tom Mulcair's, when he was leader of the NDP, taken to task for doing exactly that, by putting partisan political staff into constituency offices. We've seen it with the MP's householder, and the Legislative Assembly Management Committee has to come back and set stringent rules to ensure that the monies that are given to MLAs to do their jobs and to the political parties represented in the legislature to do theirs are done in a nonpartisan manner, not expended in a way to try to give them a political advantage going into an election so they don't have to dip into their own bank account.
And you've also found that last summer when Doug Leppard, who was working on a police act investigation of then-Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz, he was trying to reach out to ex-Speaker Linda Reid, who is still BC Liberal MLA in one of the Richmond ridings. Linda Reid had made herself scarce. She wasn't available for any face-to-face or even phone interviews. But you found something very interesting about what Linda Reid was actually doing at that time.
Well, Linda Reid at the time claimed that she'd been away for a few weeks. This is what she told Mr. Leppard. And she directed him to her legal counsel. Well, when you go through her expense claims, what you find is on July 21, Linda Reid was at work as an MLA. On July 22nd, she received an email from Doug Leppard. Now, sometime between July 21st and 22nd, she caught a ferry to Victoria, British Columbia. And someone else, on July 22nd, got a Harbor Air flight to Victoria, and that would be Andrew Wilkinson. You go through, page by page, Linda Reid's travel expenses. It is very clear she was not away for a few weeks, and she was very much at work, and was very much at work all the way up until July 29th, when she went to a caucus meeting in Kitimat Terrace, B.C. She had the opportunity to meet him. She lied to the public when she claimed that she was out of town, and she lied to Doug Leppard. Now, I think it would be interesting to know if Doug Leppard had first phoned asking for a meeting. Was there any earlier communication between herself and Doug Leppard indicating that he wanted to meet with her? Did Gary Lenz give her a heads up that Doug Leppard was going to be wanting to meet her? Did Andrew Wilkinson, when he was in Victoria, sit down with Linda Reid to discuss the situation? These are all the questions that now jump out of those expense claims that she filed.
I also asked Dermot Travis about the Ben Stewart case. The Kelowna West BC Liberal MLA resigned from caucus last summer, pending the results of an Elections BC investigation into a campaign finance issue. Neither Stewart nor Elections BC have commented on the allegations, and Elections BC is now resisting efforts by the Breaker.News to obtain a copy of the investigation report under the Freedom of Information Law. Travis said that the BC Liberals haven't wrapped their heads around a very simple principle.
If you don't want to answer questions from the public, then don't run for public office. And what we find too often with some of the MLAs in the province, when they find they're knee-high in muck, that they want the public to know as little as possible. And quite frankly, it doesn't work to their advantage. If they were upfront and forward with the terms of all of the details to such matters. It would be a one-day, two-day wonder in the media. Doing what they're doing now simply drags it out. And you have this anomaly in the election finance law. And based on a little information that we do know related to Ben Stewart's situation, it's pertinent. If a company, such as Quail's Winery, gives an individual $1,000 to donate to a political party, but in that individual's name, that's against the law. And that's why we have an RCMP investigation that's been ongoing now for more than 2 years into lobbyists doing exactly that, making donations on behalf of their clients. However, if an individual makes an offer to you of $1,000 to donate to a political party, that, under the law, is not a violation of the law. Which, quite frankly, unless Elections BC is subpoenaing the necessary bank records to determine where the $1,000 first originated from, it is incredibly difficult to be able to nail down whether or not that $1,000 came from an individual, or that $1,000 came from a company, or did it come from an individual who then got reimbursed by a company. It would be a good opportunity for Ben Stewart to put forward exactly what the complaint was about, how it was resolved, and to take questions from the media, not by email, but by face-to-face news conference, to determine the exact origins of whatever funds were under investigation by Elections BC.
Meanwhile, the NDP has not followed through on promised amendments to the FOI law in the wake of Speaker Daryl Plekis's January 2019 report on the legislature corruption scandal.
I think it's an opportunity, particularly if the Premier decides he wants to go into an early election, to put these two issues to rest quickly by introducing the necessary legislation and by also making certain that it is all-encompassing legislation. It's not how little can we get away with, but rather how much out there can we make certain is available to the public. I'm scared that we're going to hear in the negotiations over extending freedom of information to the legislature, the various caucuses will want to have certain types of documents exempt. Well, we need to have that debate. Let's have that debate. But let's not have it behind closed doors. Let's not have it where the public cannot follow along to see what the debate is. I also think, given the amount of money that each caucus receives, that they should be required to put out annual financial statements, which my understanding is they do prepare for their internal purposes, but that those financial statements should be made public, and that the same types of documents that you might want to access through freedom of information related to any type of financial transaction in any other part of government should apply to the legislature as well.
My guest this week was Dermot Travis, Executive Director of Integrity BC. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Port Coquitlam City Council, led by Mayor Brad West, for keeping this year's tax increase under the rate of inflation, and for not using those two horrible cliches. They're not comparing it to the price of a latte, and they're not saying that they're going to put more money in your pocket. The world needs less political spin and a lot more tax restraint. So good on Port Coquitlam City Council for bucking the Lower Mainland trend. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 12th, 2020. I'm Bob Mack, and thanks for joining me. Did you know that on January 12th in 1991, the U.S. Congress voted to send troops to drive Iraq out of Kuwait? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews, patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.